The Newsagent and the Counselor by Don Howarth, with Maggie Steed and Stephen Moore. Wednesday, the 13th of May.
Come in, Mr. Sutton. Have a seat.
Thank you.
Now, an appointment had been made for you to see Colin.
Colin?
Colin McKay, our senior counsellor. Unfortunately, he's had to go to a meeting with the Director of Social Services at short notice. Would you like to talk to me?
Yes, all right.
Just the basic facts. I'll make a note and then see Colin next time and go on from there.
Whatever suits you.
I see you were referred to us by Dr. Bowen.
Yes.
He spoke to Colin on the telephone.
He said he would, to somebody here.
And Colin, thinking he was going to see you himself, made this note, which tells us not very much.
Oh?
Stress, it says. Family relationships. What happened?
I threw a music center through the window.
Ground floor?
Bedroom. My son's bedroom.
Your son's music center?
Stepson. He phoned for the police.
That's a bit extreme. Did they come?
Yes. Having landed on the pavement, it was in what you might call the public domain.
You might have killed somebody.
That's what they said.
Did they caution you?
Not formally. Inspector Midgley came to the shop. He's an old friend.
Well, that's useful.
Policemen have always come into the shop for a warm-up and a cup of tea early mornings.
You're a newsagent, the note says.
Yes.
What time do you open?
7:30. But I'm down there from home shortly after 5, putting the papers up for delivery boys and girls.
You're up while the town's still sleeping.
There aren't many about. Me, the police, the undertaker, sometimes comes in and tells me who's died during the night.
What did the inspector have to say?
Talk round it. He suffered a bit of nervous trouble himself. Advised me to see a doctor.
Had you not been feeling well?
Not so much unwell as tired. Irritable. I haven't been sleeping well.
And the doctor diagnosed stress?
Yes. He gave me some pills. He said there wasn't too much of a medical problem, but come and talk to you people at the counselling service.
Well, we'll help if we can.
Thank you.
What brought it on?
You mean over the years or just the incident?
Well, just the incident to begin with.
Kevin switched his set on full blast after midnight.
You were in bed?
I hit the sack at 10:30 after news at 10. I need 6 hours.
Certainly.
Even then, he's got headphones and earpieces in his bedroom. He can put it through his own head all night at any volume he likes, if only he spares the rest of us.
Does he not have to get up in the morning?
Not till 7. He starts in the shop at 8.
How old is he?
18.
Would it be any solution if he came and did the early shift with you at 5 o'clock?
There's only one job at that time, putting up the papers for the delivery rounds. He can't do it.
What's involved?
Well, the papers come from the wholesalers. All Daily Expresses in one pile, Daily Mirrors in another, Suns, Mails, etc., all in their own piles. They've got to be resorted into street order and put up in bundles for delivery.
Is there a checklist to work to?
There is, but there isn't time to consult it. You've got to rely on memory.
I suppose everybody's got to start sometime.
Not Kevin. He's a non-starter.
Have you tried him at it?
I gave him 3 afternoons off to learn the checklist for just one street. Then, one day, I go home, he comes over, he shoves the list in my top pocket. This is rubbish, he says. I'm not going to fill my mind with rubbish. My mind's not a dustbin.
Was your wife there?
Meryl, yes. She said he ought to try his best, but she agreed with him his mind shouldn't be used as a dustbin.
Does she sort of mediate in arguments?
Oh, they're incidents, really, not arguments. I've never argued with anybody. Yes, she tries to keep a balance.
Are there other children?
Tracy, Meryl's daughter. She's 19.
How long have you been married?
5 years. Meryl was divorced.
You were happy to take on a ready-made family?
Very happy. I've been living alone in a biggish family house. They brought a bit of life to the place.
Yes. But the girl...
Tracy.
Does she work at the shop, too?
She did. She left to go to a boutique.
After a row?
No, just preferred selling clothes. She's moved on again since then, to a video shop.
How did she do in your shop?
She's a nice, bright girl to have around, but unfortunately, she wasn't at school when they were teaching arithmetic. She has trouble giving change.
Working in shops for any length of time, surely she must be able to manage it.
Given time to punch it up on the till. I'm sorry, really, she didn't stay. There's always a laugh when Tracy's around. She's an easy, outgoing person, like her mother. Good with customers, change apart, especially old people.
Why did she move on from the boutique?
Well, they do, don't they? Kids now.
Is it the boy's first job?
First he's stuck at.
Have you yourself been in the trade a long time?
It was my father's business. I was born above the shop.
I wonder perhaps if you underestimate the difficulties of a young person coming new to the job.
It's not everybody's cup of tea. Tracy would have learned.
And what about Kevin?
He could learn if he put himself to it. You can't tell him things. He won't listen. I know, he says. I know. His mother said, don't you tell him. He might feel he has to oppose you. Let Mrs. Jackson tell him.
Well, why should he feel he has to oppose you?
Well, authority of any sort. They bridle at it.
Who's Mrs. Jackson?
She's the manageress. In charge most of the daytime. Same reaction to her. Half turning his back. I know, he says. I know.
Annoying. But that apart, does he work reasonably well?
He does his threepenneth.
You mean a bare minimum?
Yes. He can serve passably well, but he just won't trouble himself to be civil to people. Throws the fags across, takes the money and tosses over the change, and on to the next customer when we're busy.
Which is what you want.
Yes, or back to the magazine he's reading on the counter when we're not. Customers are people. They have names. They deserve a word, or at least a smile. Speak to folk, Mrs. Jackson told him. What about, he asked. Anything, she said. Football? The weather? I'm not paid to be a parrot, he says. He's got his grudging trade union attitudes, like a lot of kids now. Several mornings, when he first started, I rang up home for him to come and do the round for one of the delivery lads who hadn't turned up. One excuse and another. He hadn't had his breakfast. His anorak wasn't waterproof. He wasn't going to do the tower blocks because they were full of hooligans and Alsatians. Then it came straight out. My time's 8 to 5, he says. I'm not a fireman on permanent standby.
So who delivered the papers?
Who do you think? I can sometimes get in a boy or a girl on the telephone, otherwise it's me. Lock up and get round quick if I can make the time early. Otherwise, it's got to wait until the morning rush finishes after 9 o'clock, which is not good enough.
What did your wife think about it?
She had a solution to this particular problem. Buy him a little car, she says. He might be more willing if he was to be a bit more mobile again.
Again?
He had a motorbike that was whipped from outside a disco. You could run a little car on the business medal, said, and it'd be handy for all of us.
Could you?
Oh, it couldn't be charged against the business. The Inland Revenue won't wear the second car for the lock-up shook with my turnover. Anyway, it wouldn't change Kevin. He's just not one of nature's newsagents.
Do you think perhaps he feels trapped in the job?
There's no doubt he does. But he's no more tired than Tracy was. He could quit tomorrow if he could get a job that would suit him better, but he can't.
You pay him, what, the going rate?
There isn't a going rate for his age. I pay him 120.
That's quite good.
He lives free at home.
He doesn't pay for his board.
The medal won't take it. That's how he was able to find the deposit for the motorbike. But he didn't have enough, apparently, for proper insurance as well. So when the bike was nicked, he was left with months of hire purchase to pay for nothing.
Did you help him?
I paid it off.
What effect did that have?
It seemed, if anything, to make him more resentful.
Well, he'd feel a fool.
Yes, well, I didn't expect a vote of thanks. But I'm not too pleased to see the question of a second car reappearing on the agenda from time to time.
Brought up by him?
No, by Merrill. Most recently, because I've drawn the line at lending him my car in the evening.
He asked?
No, she asked on his behalf. It's not reasonable. I must have the car in the early morning. Simply can't be risked on kids' late-night joyrides.
No, of course not.
Sad thing is, we used to be quite good pals, Kevin and me. I took him around football matches, speedway, museums, air displays. Oh, it's a pity he ever came to the shop.
Yes. Working with relations. I worked in my husband's office briefly. Very briefly. Interesting. Well, I'd like to hear more, but my own client is waiting, so I'm afraid we'll have to leave it at that for now. You've given me a very clear picture, but obviously the problem goes rather deeper.
Yes.
It might be better in any case to wait until you see Colin before going into further details. I'll leave a note in your file. You'll find it easy to talk to him.
I find it easier to talk to you.
Well, we've made a start together. If you'd like to see me again, I could ask Colin.
Yes, I would.
I'm only part-time. I'm only here Wednesdays and Fridays.
Wednesday's fine. Half-day closing.
Next Wednesday, then. 2:30, all right?
Fine.
Colin permitting.
Wednesday, the 20th of May.
Nice to see you again. What shall I call you? Mr. Sutton?
No. I look round for my father whenever anybody says that.
Harold, then.
Please.
I'm Laura. Perhaps you'll tell me about your father.
Sure. I thought, after I left last week, that I'd rather overstated things about Kevin. These incidents, you know, they're at longish intervals. The lad's only one item in the equation.
Of course. You've had a reasonable week. No more incidents.
Nothing more thrown through the window. Meryl's talking about getting a job.
Your wife?
Yes.
Boredom or money?
Money.
Is that short?
No. I give her 300 a week. Clothes money, anything she wants within reason.
So what's this for? Something beyond reason?
The second car she's been talking about.
Her solution is to get a job and buy one with her earnings?
Yes.
Wouldn't that solve the problem?
It'd solve one problem by creating another. In our business, with two of us coming and going all day, there's got to be somebody to keep the home running and make the meals.
Which is Meryl, whether she likes it or not.
It's any woman in our business.
What's special about newsagents?
Well, as I said, the hours, meals, coming and going. I have a bite on the hoof before 5 o'clock, then home for a proper breakfast between 9 and 10. Kevin takes his breakfast after 7, and he's home for dinner at 12 when I go down to the shop to do the lunchtime. Then I'm back for a sandwich early afternoon. He's through at 5 and wants his tea, and I'm ready for an evening meal when I finish the late stint at 7:30.
I haven't quite grasped the details, but I see the difficulty. Might it not be helpful in several ways if you took the evening meal together?
When I've finished?
Yes.
The kids won't wait till then. They want their tea and get out.
And they tell you?
They tell their mother.
What do you suppose would happen if she got a job?
It'd be more chaotic than it is now. It just hasn't been thought through.
The business very much dominates the pattern of all your lives, doesn't it?
It keeps us all.
How much free time does it leave you with?
2 or 3 hours in the morning and 3 in the afternoon.
Fragments.
I've got to do both ends of the day. Kevin can't do the morning and he wouldn't do the evening. In any case, I don't really want to leave him down there by himself.
What do you do in your spare time?
Oh, there's always a bit of running about to be done. To the wholesalers or the cash and carry. I do the books, keep the VAT up to date.
But that's more work, not free time.
I read, look at maps. I listen to the radio, watch the telly if there's a good film on. I have a doss some days, catch up with my sleep. I play golf.
Oh, where?
Up the road, Oakside.
My husband was captain there, Gerald Varley.
I've spoken to him. I don't know many of the members. On midweek afternoons, the only ones there are old men, ladies, and newsagents. Do you play?
Yes, I do. Not at Oakside. You were starting to tell me about your father.
Oh, yes.
Was he born into the business, too?
No. He'd been a coal miner, though you'd never have guessed it to see him behind the counter. He was very spruce, like a sergeant major off parade. Sports coat, usually. Always a tie. He'd always wanted a shop. I don't know why. He thought owning a newsagent's the best thing in life, the pinnacle of society.
And your mother? Was she part of the enterprise?
Very much so. She kept the home going and the meals turning up above the shop and later in the house where I live now, up the road. She took her apron off and came down and served at busy times.
Took her apron off?
Oh, yes, she'd always to look right for the shop. Me too. I had to wear a jacket or a blazer. I served after school and Saturday mornings.
Do you think that was right?
Yes. Well, he let me off Saturday mornings when I played football and cricket in the school teams. He let me off altogether when I was doing O-levels. He was always very reasonable.
Was there ever any question of your going into another job?
It was never discussed. I was quite pleased to get away on national service for a change. I've always been keen on foreign travel, and I looked forward to the prospect of doing a different kind of job.
What did you do?
They made me a storeman at Catterick. So the change I got was a draftier shop and the pleasure of handing out working overalls and gumboots instead of newspapers and cigarettes. Ah, it was very good, really. He gave me 4 weeks' holiday. 6 some years, though he never took more than a fortnight himself.
To do something specific?
Only travel. Aimless travel, I suppose. I've visited most parts of the globe at one time and another. Not South America yet. It's a great feeling to get out into the sun in some distant place with the time all your own.
I know what you mean.
Do you travel?
No, no. Only tourist routes. But I do know the feeling. We used to take a house on the Costa del Sol. My husband and son once left me behind there, not feeling too well, for a couple of days while they made a trip through the hills to Seville. I felt rather blank when they drove off, but it turned into a very agreeable 2 days. I do know what you mean about feeling the sun on your back and the time all your own. I didn't do anything. Strolled about the streets, stretched out for a couple of hours on the beach. In the evening, I dressed and went out to a good restaurant. I had a table to myself. I'd never done that before.
It's like being somebody else, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly what it's like. I wish they wouldn't come back, which is very sinful. Not so soon, at any rate.
Yes.
And what do you do now?
For holidays?
Yes.
Nothing much. We had a couple of package fortnights when the kids were younger, but they don't want to come with us any longer. Kevin and I can't be away from the shop at the same time. And in any case, Mrs. Jackson won't be left with him for so long.
The manageress?
Yes. An old friend, really. She's near retirement now. I depend on her and she depends on the job. Her husband's been an invalid half his life. She came when my mother was taken ill and stayed on when she died.
You lived with your parents?
Yes. We got a part-time housekeeper after Mother died. She stayed on with me until a couple of years before I married.
Did you enjoy working with your father?
Who does, really? I was happier on shifts when he wasn't there.
Why?
He gave me the feeling that nothing I did was quite good enough.
Discouraged you?
No, not really. He just demanded perfection. No, he pushed me ahead. I did the round for absentee newsboys from the age of 9 or 10. I could put up the papers as fast as he could when I was 16. I know he often praised me to my mother.
But not to yourself?
He never put it into words. But in fairness, he seldom put his criticism into words either.
Then how did he convey it?
By a sort of dead response to what I might say, as though I hadn't spoken. Do you know what I mean?
I do indeed.
Little things Mrs. Jackson and I arranged about the shop, he'd go over and rearrange. In slack times, if we got into conversation with a customer he knew, he'd come and take it over.
Annoying.
Yes. He knew he could rely on us, but he always managed to convey a slight reservation about the way we'd done things. Can you understand that?
Any woman could understand that.
You've had this experience?
Oh, I was a girl in a family of boys. I'm a woman living with a husband and a grown son. You didn't have much discussion?
No. Well, the type of business doesn't really lend itself to that. The only question of any size in his time was the pace of modernization, how far to go over to open shelves and self-service.
Which he wouldn't have liked.
He detested it. He couldn't abide the prospect of customers with magazines under their elbows paddling about in wet boots and rummaging into the pick-and-mix toffee bins.
When did he give up?
10 years ago. He developed bronchitis. He came down and served when he was better side out. Then it got a bit much and he went to live with my sister. He died 7 years ago.
And you inherited the shop?
In effect. I was buying it from him on a mortgage, but then he left everything between my sister and me, so I wholly own the shop and the house.
So, financially he did quite well for you?
He did very well.
And no financial problems now?
No. We do feel the squeeze of increasing competition. On the one side, the multiples expanding all the time, and on the other, the packy shops open till midnight.
Do you regard that as unfair competition?
No. They provide a late-night service we don't provide. If they can get their families to sit by the till until 11 p.m, good luck to them. I couldn't get mine. Price-cutting on cigarettes is the main thing. In most lines, they're not directly competitive, Newspapers, well, there are enough newsagents in this town. We don't allow anybody else to handle papers.
We meaning white shopkeepers?
We meaning newsagents.
Who are white?
Not all.
Good. Well, perhaps we'll leave it at that for today.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have gone on about my father and the business.
I asked you. It's important background. But coming back for a moment to the particular question you mentioned, what do you think you might do about your wife's wanting to go back to work?
It's just not practical.
If what she really wants out of a job is a car for the three of them to use, wouldn't it help for the present if you're at least willing to consider buying them an old one? Could you afford that?
Well, I suppose so. Insurance to cover two teenage drivers would cost a bob or two. I don't know. The thing is, they never look after anything. A car would delight them for a week. Then it'd be left full of chip wrappers with the tyres down and the oil below the dipstick. It'd finish with me having to look after it.
Why should it?
Well, otherwise it'd be a non-runner within a few months.
Well, that might teach them a lesson.
It's an expensive way of teaching a lesson.
It's not the money that troubles you, is it, Harold? You just couldn't stand by and see it run down, could you?
No.
I don't suppose I could either. Perhaps we'd both do better if we were a bit easier going. Let's talk again next Wednesday. See if we can't make some more progress.
Wednesday, the 27th of May.
Harold, come in. I've been trying to telephone you.
I left early to call round by the wholesalers.
The thing is, I'm going to have to cut our session short today. I'm terribly sorry.
Oh, it's all right.
The garage rang an hour ago. My car won't be ready and something's come up at home. And I'll have to get the bus, which means leaving at 3.
I could give you a lift.
Don't dream of it. I live out in the country near Hopewell.
My time's my own until 5. I'd be pleased to.
Would you?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I do have rather a load of shopping, food I've had to buy.
No trouble.
Well, thank you. I've cancelled my later sessions now, so if you really don't mind.
Not at all.
We needn't feel pressed.
Fine.
Would that be your wife I spoke to?
Or Tracy. She's at home at present. They sound very much alike on the phone.
Does Meryl know you come here for counselling?
Yes. She's very much in favour. She's as worried in her way as I am.
Is she the worrying type?
No, no. Normally, she's outgoing and funny. She has all the virtues I lack.
Perhaps you have some virtues she lacks.
I don't know.
You compliment each other?
I suppose we do.
If there were just the two of you, there'd be no problem?
No.
How did you meet her?
She came to work at the shop.
After your father's time?
Yes, 6 years ago.
Was she married then?
Divorced.
And how did things develop?
Well, because of her generous spirit, I suppose. She's completely unpredictable. She'd turn up 20 minutes late without any excuse, but then she'd stay on for a couple of hours if we were busy, or go and clean the house without expecting to get paid for it.
Your house?
Yes, well, it had got a bit scruffy. The housekeeper we had retired, and I was living in the place alone. One afternoon, I sent Meryl up for the VAT book. She was away quite a long time. Then, when I got home in the evening, I found she'd tidied the whole place up. After that, she took on the cleaning on a proper paid basis. But then she'd go and spend part of what I gave her on replacing cups or buying flowers for the place. She got my video recorder mended. When my birthday came round, she had a big meal ready.
Nice. Mm.
We got into the habit of having a meal together one night a week. Tuesdays, for some reason. Sometimes we went to restaurants. We drove out into the country for tea on half-day closing. She'd stay overnight sometimes.
Her children knew where she was?
Oh, yes, they rang up to speak to her. If they needed something not too urgent, I gave her a lift home before I went to the shop early morning. Sometimes she slept in until her own starting time. Occasionally, on nice days, she came down to the shop with me at 5 to keep me company. I didn't encourage that.
Why?
Well, I'd sooner be by myself when I'm putting the papers up. No distractions. And Mrs. Jackson was troubled to know how Meryl came to arrive so early.
It was a good sexual relationship?
Yes.
Still is?
Well, yes. As far as I'm competent to judge. Living with parents and working early morning, late evening isn't the kind of life to furnish all that wider range of comparison.
Oh, I think you'd know. You didn't feel in any way trapped into marriage?
Not in the least. We got on well. We enjoyed each other's company. It seemed a sensible thing all round. Me on my own, them in a little council house, and Meryl coming and going.
Did Mrs. Jackson take a view?
She blessed the union. It put an end to possible scandal, and it drew Meryl into the home and away from the shop, where Mrs. Jackson perhaps felt a bit outshone. She confided her opinion that Meryl would learn to be a very good newsagent's wife.
Learn to be?
Oh, yes. Everybody has a long probation in our business. It also, as far as Mrs. Jackson was concerned, put an end to speculation that I might sell the shop and leave her without a job.
Who was speculating?
Oh, just shopkeeper talk. Alan Greaves, who has the newsagents in the High Street, was keen to buy the place for one of his sons. Still is. Made me a good offer.
Which you considered?
I thought about it. I've always had this thing about wanting to travel.
You said so.
And living alone, working those hours, I'd sometimes think, life's passing by. What am I stuck here for?
Marrying Meryl made sense of it again.
Yes. It's a family job.
And the children at that time were what age?
14, Tracy, and 13, Kevin.
You liked them at first acquaintance?
Yes, Tracy, everybody likes. She's got this comic, naive thing. She makes people laugh without knowing herself half the time what she's said.
Yes.
Kevin was more difficult. He's always been sort of broody, secretive. He took it badly, Meryl said, when his father went off.
But you got on quite well with him, you told me, at the beginning.
Yes.
So what changed?
Came to work in the shop, for one thing.
What other things?
He grew up. It's the manners he's picked up, the people he's got in with.
Other youths?
Yes, their attitudes. They've all been brought up on rights and resentment. They have a twisted mouth contempt for everything. They won't work. Nothing makes them smile. They defy you to please them. You must have met them.
No, I'm not laughing at you. Teenagers. It's a thing I hear 5 times a week. Now, you say he took it badly when his father went off.
Meryl said so.
What sort of a man was his father?
Oh, happy-go-lucky. Very much like Meryl and Tracy in some ways. Sideburns and a kipper tie. He's been to see us several times. One time he brought us a magnum of champagne. Another visit turned up with a tame rabbit he'd won in a raffle.
You have rather a liking for that sort of person.
They're different. Mm. I believe they never knew where they'd be living from one month to the next. He went around making deals. They'd have a Jaguar one week, and they'd all be on the bus the next. They once had a country place with a swimming pool and ponies. Another time they lived in a caravan. They finished, when he ditched them, in the council house. He went off to Bermuda with a rich woman who apparently insisted on his getting a divorce.
How did Meryl come out of it? To get, what, a half share of his estate?
Yes, which at that time was a half share of nothing.
And alimony?
He paid when he remembered, and when he'd got it.
Interesting. Do you think we might make a move and talk as we go?
Yeah, sure.
The thing is, I would like to get home, and if you really wouldn't mind giving me a lift...
Not at all.
Something has been rather suddenly sprung on me.
Sure.
We can carry on talking. Oh, all is forgiven. The lovely Mrs. Bevett has been. Dump the bags by the table, if you would. Everything back in place in the sitting room. Do come through.
Well, that's a fine house.
Oh, what a relief. We had some friends to supper last night who stayed rather late, and I dashed out this morning and left the place a bit of a dump. Then, when I got in the office, my husband was on the line, sounding rather urgent. Some important people unexpectedly appearing on the horizon, whom he was rather desperate to have round. I didn't dare tell him my car was in 100 pieces in the garage. It's not one of Mrs. Bevitt's cleaning days here, and I got no reply on her telephone. Anyway, the village tom-toms worked. The message got through.
You must have had a Harris day.
Yes. I think we deserve some tea.
Oh.
Come into the kitchen. It's warmer. We don't have the heat on in the other rooms when we're out during the day.
It's a big place to keep warm.
These people who have been sprung upon me, they really are very important to Gerald. You know my husband, don't you?
We've spoken at the golf club.
He's a barrister, as perhaps you know.
Yes.
And what this is all about, he's in the running to be a parliamentary candidate.
An MP?
Yes. He's had two or three goes in hopeless constituencies, which they've all got to do unless they're especially favoured.
Yes.
But now he's graduated to greener pastures. At least we hope he has. He's on the shortlist.
Good.
And the people he's bringing have something to do with selection. They've already had us both in for interview.
You as well?
Oh, yes. They need to make sure they're not going to be landed with somebody from the front line of the chorus. Or, in more recent times, a lady from some branch of the demo industry. And I suppose they now want to press their investigations a step further by inspecting us in our native habitat.
I'm sure you'll make a good impression.
Thanks to you and Mrs. Bevitt, we ought to. We might have done less well if I'd been bustling around washing last night's glasses and emptying the ashtrays when they arrived. I suspect they have reservations about my job. Counselling.
Why?
Well, it has a leftish sort of a tinge, doesn't it?
Does it?
Well, yes, to them, any social service. But everybody down at the centre wears socks. We've only one man with a single earring. Milk or lemon?
Milk, please. How did you get into the counselling business? Is it something you graduate for at university?
There might be some relevant degree. I don't know. I didn't go to university. I was married at 19. No, I was asked, and I'm very glad I took it on. I adore this house and living here, but it can be a bit lonely if you don't have your own thing to do.
I can imagine.
Country life is a man's world, really. My husband and son, when he's down from Oxford, hunt and shoot, which some women can, of course, but I don't. We have some good weekends. Would you like some cake?
Thank you. What do you do on weekdays?
There's no shortage of jobs. Horses to see to. I ride a bit. And the dogs to walk, and I don't know. There's always something to be done. But one does miss people. I go and play quite a lot of golf. I've taken on one or two things at church and in the village. And, oh, yes, I became a magistrate. I sign people's documents and sit sternly on the bench every third Monday. Then this counselling came up. Though why they picked me with my cloistered experience, I shall never know.
You're a good listener.
If I am, it's one of the few things I learnt at school. I also learned to speak French and arrange flowers. I think I learned more on the counselling course than in all the years at school.
Really?
Yes. That and mixing with people, Colin and the others down at the centre. I have at least learned to recognise and confront my own prejudices.
Prejudices?
Yes. Or, more generally, the way one looks at things. I find myself putting a mental question mark to some of the things Gerald says, or that we've always taken for granted. I seldom chirp up. I'm not good at argument. Philip?
No, thanks.
Some more cake?
No, I must be going.
Harold, don't give up travel.
Travel?
You did so enjoy it, didn't you?
Yes, when it was possible.
Once things are sorted out, you should try to make it possible. It's the perfect foil to your daily routine, just as my bits of activity are for me. Oasis in the desert. No, that's overstating it. But you know what I mean?
Yes. Sure.
Thank you for the lift.
Thank you for the tea.
We'll meet next Wednesday at the centre.
Fine.
Wednesday, the 3rd of June.
Harold.
How did your dinner party go?
Very well. They're ogres and dragons, some of these selection people, but this lot turned out to be a very happy little band. Gerald has the highest hopes.
I'm glad.
Another hurdle leapt. And how have things been with you? Any developments?
Well, not really. This thing about Tracy's boyfriend has come back on the agenda.
I don't think I know about that.
Didn't I tell you?
I don't think so.
Oh, well, in brief, the ladies want him to move in. Kevin says not at any price.
Another subject for dissension.
Yes.
It's of recent origin, isn't it, this disharmony? Things went quite well for some time after they first arrived. So when did things start to go wrong?
Looking back, there always was a lurking problem. They never really settled down to the life. They started on about the house pretty early.
About the house?
They took against living near the town centre. They wanted to go back to where their friends were.
Our children do.
Yes, but Merrill put it to me as a serious proposition. They hadn't been there 6 months. I can't just live anywhere. I've got to be within walking distance of the shop when the road's snowed up or the car won't start. She knew I should work there.
Then she'd see your point.
Oh, yes. But she's always looking for a compromise to keep the peace.
Compromise between you and the children?
Yes. She landed back with the estate agent's brochures of houses for sale.
In their old district?
No, she accepted that we couldn't go out there. Just different houses. If we couldn't move where they wanted to go, then let's just move somewhere.
Then what was the next bone of contention?
I suppose the smoking campaign. Look, I really shouldn't go on niggling about these petty annoyances. They don't amount to much.
Well, they amount to enough to make you throw a music centre through the window. What was the smoking campaign?
Kevin took against selling cigarettes. He said we were profiteering out of people's deaths.
Was he sincere?
Partly, no doubt. But it was brought on by a niggle about something quite different. About changing his lunch hour, I think. I put it to him that it'd make no difference to the nation's health whether we, in our little business, sold cigarettes or not. If we didn't do it, somebody else would. He said the guards at Auschwitz could have said that.
That's sometimes the style of youthful argument.
Merrill said something of the sort. Explain it to him proper.
This video was uploaded to the channel Thinking Out Louder. Please like, comment and subscribe to the Thinking Out Louder channel. Thank you.
Happily, she said. So I tried. I got out some simplified figures and made some diagrams, and I took him into the room at home I use as an office, and I patiently went through it. The proportion of our profit that came from cigarettes and a broad estimate of takings in other lines generated by cigarettes bringing people into the shop. Without them, we're not really in business.
Did he grasp that?
He wouldn't even try to take it in. He said he didn't understand figures. He couldn't read diagrams. And Merrill eventually managed to make him take the point. He said in that case, we should sell the business and go into something else. Which went down like a bomb in the family circle, everyone full of suggestions. Merrill got very excited about the idea of going into children's fashion clothes. Tracy foresaw the added blessing of us all being free to move back to the district they came from. That all sank out of sight. Then, one afternoon, when I got back to the shop, I found Kevin had nailed up on the cigarette shelves a lurid picture of rotted lungs, which Merrill agreed couldn't be allowed to go on. She suggested, as a compromise, that I might reorganise the shop so that all the cigarette sales happened at one side and Kevin could stay on the other and sell other lines.
Would that be practical?
Oh, no, she knew it wouldn't. It was just intended to keep the peace. She expected I'd find excuses for putting it off, and time had passed, and eventually his protest would fizzle out.
Perhaps it might.
You can't make promises you don't intend to keep.
No.
You can't run a business like that.
No. Did it occur to anybody that Kevin might ease his conscience by leaving the shop and getting another job?
I'd never suggest that. He'd be back on the dole or punching the till at a filling station. The lad's education is all against him. As kids, they were shifted round from one house to another and sent to a dozen different schools, none of them much good as far as I can make out.
What happened to his protest?
It smoulders on from time to time. He's in a bit of a minority. Merrill smokes and Tracy.
But you don't?
No. And most of the yobbos he hangs around with.
His friends?
Yes.
Do you know them? Do you know their names?
I think they're all called Wayne. Or Darren.
They are, in fact, all individuals.
You wouldn't know it. They all have the same gear and the same funny haircuts and pasty faces. They always go round in small mobs.
Why should that bother you?
Well, it doesn't, as long as they stay out of the shop.
They come in looking for Kevin?
They did. I've stopped that off.
Why?
Have you seen them? They're 6 foot tall. They don't move for people. They all have that look of numbskull brutality. Would you go into a shop where they were loafing around, leafing through the motorbike and girly magazines? They frighten people.
Yes.
Oh, you're right, no doubt. They're not bad lads if you knew them individually, but they all seem to have this grudging, grievance thing. And Kevin is awkward enough without their encouragement.
At home, as well as at the shop?
Yes. He'd go for days without a civil word to anybody. Then, for no apparent reason, he blossoms out into an exhibition of mickey-taking.
Against you?
Less against me than against his mother and Tracy, but it's wearisome, whoever it's against. He has a go at me to show off in front of Tracy and her boyfriend.
About what?
Well, whatever crops up. More than once about my travel reading. I sometimes get out the maps and airline schedules, going over where I've been or where I might go someday.
Yes.
He's going to the end of the Amazon, he'll announce. Bring me back a parrot and a boiled-down human head. He thinks he's making a hit.
Yes.
Then he'll turn it on to the television news, sitting there making comments and looking round for their approval.
What sort of comments?
Well, political comments of a puerile sort.
How do you react?
I bear with it if it's brief. Sometimes I tell him to belt up. Ah, you're a fascist, he'll say. All tobacconists are fascists.
Didn't somebody say that once?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not really sure what a fascist is.
Do you have any political allegiances?
No, no. Politics don't jibe with running a shop. You agree with everybody and round it off with a friendly laugh, whatever it's about. Politics, weather, football, whatever. Three bags full, sir. Call again. And these are just niggles. It blows them up to talk about them. It's not so much a matter of specific issues. The house has just got unharmonious. It's physically uncomfortable. I don't know. It's like a railway refreshment room. People are coming and going all day and half the night.
Well, because of the business, partly.
Partly. We seldom sit down to a meal together, even Sundays. They eat on the hoof at all sorts of times. They leave cups and plates about, newspapers, anything they've had out. It's all left for Merrill to tidy up. They muck up the fridge. They leave the clothes on the bedroom floor.
Have you spoken about it?
Once or twice. But then Merrill gets on edge. She scuttles round tidying up before I come in, but I don't want her to have to do that. It can only make me seem oppressive to her, and that's wrong.
Yes.
Latest thing is that Tracy and her boyfriend have taken it into their heads to start up some sort of mail-order business in video and sound tapes.
You said she works in a video shop.
Yeah, that's gone bust now. So they're working from home. Cables all over the floor, tapes squeaking and scrabbling. The afternoon is my time off. I might want to do the books or put my head down for a couple of hours. Well, I can't do that with that kind of din. I've gone out. I've gone to the golf club. I've gone back to the shop. I've sometimes just gone and sat in my car. I mean, there is a limit.
Yes.
Now, they've taken to going into Kevin's room and borrowing his equipment. That's touched off a real hullabaloo.
I can imagine. This boyfriend, he hasn't actually moved in.
No. And he's not going to.
Where is he living now?
Well, I don't think he has a permanent abode. He came here as a student at the Poly, but he dropped out, and he's been working at whatever he can get. Merrill thinks he ought to have a home. If it was left to her, she'd invite him to collect his kit bag and welcome aboard.
Yes.
Then a few days ago, she came up with a happy compromise. If John can't come and live in the house, could I let him and Tracy have the flat over the shop?
Could you?
It's occupied by an old couple. They've been there since my father's time. I've wanted the place for storage for years, but not at the price of chucking them out. At their age. Anyway, they have their tenants' rights. There is such a thing as the law.
Oh, Merrill must know that.
Yes, but like anything that's a bit awkward, she's reluctant to take it on board. If we don't give them somewhere, she says, Aunt Tracy's going to get herself pregnant, so the council will have to give her a flat.
It might not be so easy.
Then she returns to the subject as though I'd never explained. If they lived over the shop, she says, John could have a job in the shop and he'd be handy when you wanted him.
Is he bright enough?
Oh, yeah, he's bright enough, but we have all the staff we need. In any case, you can't load unnecessary costs onto a business just to solve a domestic problem.
What's he like, John?
Bright, amiable. He has a good presence. Not over-diligent. Black.
Black? How black?
Afro-Caribbean.
Is this what's at the bottom of the woodpile?
Woodpile?
Oh, sorry. Unintended phrase. Is this what's at the bottom of your troubles?
John's colour?
Yes.
No. Our troubles were there long before John pitched up. His arrival has added another item to them, but not because of his colour.
Is that Kevin's objection?
His pals get at him, they make cracks.
The yobbos you were talking about?
Yes, and John outshines him. That's what provokes him into showing off and making a big thing about them using his stuff.
You yourself, are you aware of any colour prejudice?
No.
It's taken a long time, Harold, for this fact to come out. Is that significant?
How? I've just answered the questions as they've come up. I did actually mention the business of John moving in at the beginning of this session.
Yes, you did. I diverted you.
Fair dues. If I'd come here and blurted out at the very beginning that we had a black youth threatening to move in, that would have been regarded as significant.
It might.
But if, as happened, the fact comes up in its natural place in the conversation, that apparently is significant too. It's a no-win situation.
I'm sorry. But we shouldn't slide over this one. If, hypothetically, you had a vacancy in the shop and Kevin wasn't in the picture, would you consider giving the job to a young black man?
Not from choice.
I see.
I wouldn't give the job to any man, and I'd be unlikely to go for anybody you'd call young. There's only really one category I'd look for, and so would any other newsagent, ladies over 40. That's where you find competence, civility, patience, cheerfulness. What other virtues are there?
Bless you. You have made my day. When we were talking about Pakistani shops, would I be right in thinking I detected an undertone of hostility?
We're hostile to any competition.
Paki shops, you called them.
What else would you call them?
But in regard to competition, which is what we were talking about, the ownership is irrelevant, and even more so the race of the owners. The competitive characteristics, as you explained, are the long opening hours and cut prices.
So, what should I say when you ask? We're threatened on one side by the multiples, and on the other by shops with long opening hours and cut prices.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
Well, yeah, you'd ask me what I meant, and I'd say what I said originally, and we'd both understand.
Yes. The question is whether we wouldn't also understand more than had actually been said.
I take your point, Laura. But coming back to our own concerns...
I'm sorry, we got a bit wide.
John's colour isn't at the root of anything. It certainly wasn't John that made me chuck the thing through the window.
No.
Actually, Kevin wasn't really to blame either, as I've since discovered. The others had been in his room and altered his settings, and when he switched on, the thing just went off at top volume, 10,000 decibels. I'd just gone to sleep. I thought the wall was coming in.
But what's happened about his set?
I promised to replace it. He's got an updated and no doubt louder model on order. Meryl had the bright idea we might claim for it on the household insurance. Tracy suggested I could say I was just carrying the set past the window and it squirted away out of my arms.
Now let's leave it there for today while we're smiling, shall we?
Sure.
Wednesday, the 10th of June.
This is going to have to be our last session together, Harold, at least for a month or so. I'm going off on holiday.
Nice.
I've had a long talk with Colin about what we've discussed together, and in the light of his insights, I'd like to put one or two points for you to think about.
Sure.
I think we know each other well enough to put some thoughts more bluntly than I usually might.
By all means.
We've got to start with you, if only because you're here and the others are not.
Sure.
And you are, in fact, the central person. I do know what a step it is to come here in the first place.
It's been easier than I thought.
But it takes some resolve, I know. I've sat on that side of the desk. It's part of the training. I hope I can be some way as enlightening to you as they were to me.
Thank you.
Now, the main benefit for me was, as I told you, that I learned to recognize my prejudices and, in some degree, to confront them.
Yes.
The lifestyle I grew up in, and indeed my private style of life now, is not that of general experience.
No.
Well, nor is yours. We're minority people. We treasure others of our sort. Your reliable Mrs. Jackson, my stalwart Mrs. Bevitt. We respect the traditional virtues. We tend to judge the present by the standards of the past.
I accept that.
Obviously, there's more freedom now, less humbug, in some directions, not all. At the same time, people are less competent, less dependable, ruder. That's the world we live in now.
Yes.
Young people have never known anything very different.
Oh, I suppose not.
Many of them grow up with the experience that nothing runs efficiently and nobody takes responsibility for seeing a job through properly.
Yes.
Your two are not especially difficult.
Oh, I didn't mean to suggest they were.
But in your case, the problem's compounded by working with Kevin. The father and son friction which you were aware of in a different form in your own youth. And by the fact that they're somebody else's children. Somebody said, hell is other people. The inner circle of hell is other people's teenage children. But if you look at things from their point of view, coming from their disorganized childhood, you must have seemed to them a very authoritative character.
No.
Efficient, meticulous, able to meet any difficulty with easy self-confidence.
Certainly not that, or I wouldn't be here.
No, but in the business, your competence must have seemed formidable. At least at the beginning.
Oh, come on, Laura. I'm only a shopkeeper.
Yes, but put yourself in Kevin's shoes. Can you imagine what sort of a shock the efficiency of the shop was to him? He'd never known anything like it.
Perhaps.
You were brought up there, Harold. It wasn't something that suddenly happened on a Monday morning.
Laura, it's only a newsagent's shop. It isn't even a semi-skilled trade. Anyone who tries can pick it up.
But Kevin won't try, because of his resentment.
Yes, a lot of them his age think nobody should give them orders.
But the resentment was there before he came to work and had to take orders, wasn't it?
To a lesser extent.
He was fond of his father, you said?
Yes.
Do you think he might have felt some hostility against you for taking his father's place?
I think he did.
The better you did for them, the more it would rub in how inadequate his father had been.
It might.
And the more hostile he might feel towards you and the alien lifestyle.
Yes, we've tried to make him welcome and part of the place, but how can he learn if he won't listen?
Perhaps he won't listen to you, Harold, because you don't listen to him.
Don't I?
I don't think so. Not at the shop. You've made it clear that both in your father's time and in yours, there's been no habit of discussion.
No.
So Kevin wouldn't have been wrong in thinking that any ideas of his aren't wanted. He can't make any input. There's no dialogue.
Laura, it's not a discussion business. You don't have dialogues on whether to carry more Mars bars and fewer crunches. You try it and see. And Metal asked me to take him on and teach him properly, which I was most willing to do. He needed to get down to it and learn. He wasn't remotely at the stage of making inputs, as you call it, or joining in dialogues.
I'm sorry. Trade jargon. I was only suggesting it as a way of drawing him in. Obviously, you don't need his views or anybody's on how to run your business. But the habit of authority, of making one's own decisions without reference to anybody else, has a way of extending itself into other areas of life. You give me the impression that at home their discussions go on and on without resolution.
Yes.
Could that be because they know that whatever they might think, it's you who in the end is going to decide?
Only on things connected with the business.
But on this latest matter, which isn't business, of whether John should be allowed to move in with Tracy, you have decided. You told me it's just not going to happen.
Well, I do draw the line at that. But it's not me against the world. Kevin won't wear it either.
You said he's outshone by John. Jealous of him, perhaps?
Yes.
You're very fond of Tracy. Are you jealous of John, too?
Oh, no. To have him move in simply goes against the grain.
against the grain of a respectable newsagent's domestic arrangements.
Yes, most people's. Would you like your son to come home and install some young lady he'd picked up in Oxford?
Well...
Or perhaps, if he was that way inclined, another bloke. Would you mind hearing them through the bedroom wall? Would you mind what people in the village said? Or what the selection committee thought? Or the look on the faces of the ladies at the garden parties?
Yes, I would. Gerald certainly would. I share your views. What I've learned here is that most of the world doesn't any longer. We've got to reconcile ourselves to that.
Well...
Does John being black make it that much more difficult?
Not more difficult. Just that bit more conspicuous to the neighbours, for what that matters.
But it does matter. It matters to you.
Yes.
Colin thought we ought not to neglect the significance of John's colour.
I don't think it is significant. Laura, we've been over it. We had our troubles long before we saw John.
But they did reach crisis point after John arrived.
He's added to the general stress. The accumulating aggro, but the blow-up would have happened sometime with John or without him, and whether he'd been black, white, yellow, or sky-blue-pink.
It is an area, as Colin said, of deep unconscious prejudices.
Laura, I can't answer that. If they're deeply unconscious, how can I know about them? Or indeed, with respect, how can you or Colin?
Oh, no. We haven't talked very much about Merrill.
Haven't we?
When I came to consult Colin, I found that, although I know quite a lot about her early on, she rather faded from the picture. Is that just the emphasis our conversation gave it, or does it correspond to something that's happened?
Well, fading into the background?
Yes. Counting for less, perhaps.
No. We've been discussing problems. We perhaps mentioned Merrill less because she's not the source of them.
Yes.
And in any case, it wouldn't feel right to discuss her in the free sort of way I can talk about the children.
Of course not. The change must have been a shock for her, too. I'm thinking particularly about being plunged from the rather wild variety of her earlier life and the excitement of your whirlwind romance. From that into a life sentence of getting meals at all hours 7 days a week.
We have Sunday off from 1 o'clock.
So I believe did Victorian domestic servants.
I know, it's tying for her. But unfortunately, that's the business we're in. She knew what to expect.
She might not have foreseen the extent to which it would have turned her into a servant.
It's not the business that's turned her into a servant. It's the kids.
Oh, you said they're untidy.
They finick about what they'll eat. They ignore her. Kevin shouts if his shirt's not ironed. She even cleans his boots for him.
Mums do. I heard of a woman who cleans her son's motorbike. You'd think she'd want to see them on their way.
But she doesn't. When she went so far as to think of installing John and Tracy in a flat above the shop, part of the idea was that they'd be close enough to come home for their meals.
So it isn't so much a matter of them not wanting to go, but of her wanting to keep them.
I'd say so.
Despite the fact that the price of that is a rather dreary life.
Yes.
Do you think, perhaps, that she clings to the identity of being a mum because it's the only one she has?
Hadn't occurred to me.
You see, Harold, the ladies over 40 whom you find so admirable for the shop are desperate for the diversion of a job, any job, to fill the time. Because their life is over.
Not at 40 plus.
The main part is. Their children have grown up. After years in which there aren't enough hours in the day, suddenly it's all over. And without a career, a future of empty days stretches before one.
Yes.
It is so. I know.
Yes.
So, Merrill's instinct, perhaps, is to cling to the present carry-on, which gives her the only role she's got, while at the same time she feels a conflicting desire to abandon it by going out and getting a job. In half her being, she hankers to get free of the lot of you, to be something better than a teenager's loblol and something less dowdy than a 7 days a week newsagent's wife.
Sure. I'd like to be something less dowdy than a 7 days-a-week newsagent, but that's the business we're in.
Perhaps that's the crux of it. Which, if it comes to a choice, means most? Your family or your business?
It doesn't come to that choice. The business is what sustains the family.
It's also what is at the center of your family problems. It's the rock on which you're all stranded.
Well,
you're not bound to the place like a serf to the land. Could the business, whether to go on with it, could it not be discussed like anything else?
By Meryl and the kids.
It's everybody's life. Why shouldn't everybody have a say?
I'll think about it.
May I make a final point and then I'm finished?
Sure.
Going back again to your father. You described his perfectionism. Nothing you did was ever good enough. But that also you've inherited from him in some degree. In this family situation, I think perhaps you expect too much of yourself and the others. You blame yourself. You're disappointed in them. There's no perfect solution to personal relationships, Harold. The best we can hope for is to get by with some bright moments and not too much pain. I hope I haven't pushed my thoughts unduly.
Not at all. You've given me a lot to think about.
I'll be away on holiday for some time. I wanted to reach some sort of positive suggestion.
You've done that.
If things begin to work out, you may not need to come again. But if you do feel you'd like to talk to somebody while I'm away, give Colin a ring. He knows the background. I'll leave him my notes.
Thank you, Laura. You've been very helpful.
We'll see.
Where are you going on holiday? Anywhere exciting?
Not really. Galloway in southern Scotland. Do you know it?
I've been there.
I have a friend who farms.
Nice area.
Friend in school days. One or two things to talk about. Oh, I don't think I told you. Gerald had a letter. They've adopted him as a candidate.
Well, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good for Gerald. I don't know.
Have a nice break.
Thank you. Don't hesitate to give Colin a ring if you want. I'll be interested to know how things work out. Good luck.
Wednesday, the 8th of July.
Harold!
I tried the office. They said you'd changed your days.
Why, just for this week. Coming back off holiday.
I'm off for a break myself.
A holiday?
Yes. I shan't be coming back to the centre again, so I wanted to thank you for all you've done to help us through.
Come in. Not in a hurry.
No, no.
Will you have some tea?
I've just had some, thanks.
Sit down.
Thank you. How did the holiday go?
Very well. Not very good weather. But lovely people. Nice change. And you? Have you sorted things out?
Yes, after a fashion. I think everybody's pleased.
Good.
I did what you said. I apologised for having taken too much for granted, and I threw everything open to debate. Say what you think. No holds barred.
Including the business?
Yes. Surprisingly, Meryl was quite alarmed at first at the prospect that we might get rid of it.
It had been a solid security.
Yes. Kevin scented an elaborate plot to get him out. I reassured him about that. Then Meryl put it to me. If he stays there, can he look forward to inheriting the business as though he were your own son?
Not unreasonable.
I explained how these things worked. Sale by personal mortgage, and I assured him I wouldn't want to hang on into my 60s. We'd hope, while we were still sufficiently mobile, to have some time to travel about the world a bit.
You're very wise.
He sat looking at me. Then he went off to his room, had a blast of music. Then he came back and said, I'm not going to live here alone and work in a newsagent shop to keep you in funds trotting about the world.
Not an easy boy.
Anyway, that was pushed off the agenda for several days by a more urgent crisis. John was about to be thrown out of his lodgings. Where could he go but to us? Poor Tracy had a very tearful week of it. Kevin dug in. If he comes, I go, he said. Poor Meryl, in the middle, dithered.
Understandably.
Yes. At the end of all the tears and aspirins and door bangings, it sorted itself out. We got his kit, but not John.
His kit?
Yes, it was in danger of being impounded. John and Tracy moved it in one afternoon when Kevin and I were out. Then they went down to the pub and had a row, and nobody's seen John since.
He'll come back.
Yeah, well, that'd be complicated. Tracy's got another bloke.
Oh, oh no!
That, it turns out, was at the bottom of her anguish. Anyway, she doesn't brood. The sun came out again. One afternoon, she and Meryl came bouncing back with a prospect to lighten all our darkness. Decorator's shop for sale in Rutledge Street. Suit us all. It had solved the main problem of the old business, our awkward hours. We'd start off having learnt the lesson on a different, more equal basis. Less income, of course. I said I'd have a look at the books. By then it was about 11 o'clock, so I went off to bed and left them buzzing. Kevin with his lager, Meryl and Tracy drinking coffee and smoking like a pair of happy bonfires. It was like a pub on somebody's birthday. And it smelled like a bar parlour when I got up next morning. I got out the cornflakes and the coffee. Then I opened the fridge. No milk. Laura, you've done your best to teach me to be more tolerant, to accept other people's disorganised ways as being no worse, just different. When I saw the milk had gone, I knew you'd failed. Anyway, I got down to the shop and started to put the papers up. I think I told you the undertaker drops in sometimes to tell me who snuffed it during the night.
Yes.
He came in hot foot from having measured up Jack Simpson, newsagent in Sparrow Lane.
The one who wanted to buy your shop?
No, that's Alan Greaves. Jack was my age, a bit older perhaps. He had a boat somewhere down in Devon. His heart was set on retiring there someday. Then, bingo, sets the radio alarm for another early start and disappears into eternity.
Oh.
I turned back to the newspapers. And suddenly, it flashed into my mind. Who the hell wants to waste his life selling paint and wallpaper? I must have said it out loud. The undertaker had stopped at the greetings cards on his way out. He looked at me as though I'd gone bonkers. And I thought, who wants to be in any business when everybody does what they feel like doing and all join in endless discussions?
Well,
Laura, you've tried to enlighten me. You spoke of recognising and confronting prejudices as though what they were confronted by was undiluted truth and wisdom. What it amounts to is something less. It's confronting one set of prejudices with another.
Which correspond more exactly to the present social reality.
Well, maybe. Analysing things in the light of fashionable attitudes doesn't alter simple facts. I asked them to share my life and work with its assets and drawbacks, and they discovered, for reasons you've helped me to make very understandable, that they didn't want it. They are what they are, and I am what I am. I have my ways, they have theirs. And I don't accept what's at the bottom of your professional assumptions, that in this life we've all got to rub along with negotiated compromises, satisfactorily, really, to nobody.
You're a romantic, Harold. It's an aspect of the perfectionism your father drilled into you.
Okay.
What happened?
I'll put it to Meryl. It hasn't worked. Let's call it a day. Split everything down the middle.
Oh! How did she take it?
Bewildered. Tearful. Then, with immense relief, as though a great weight had been taken off her.
Really?
All sunshine. A way I haven't seen her for quite a long time. I have been oppressive to her, to them. I didn't intend to be, and I wouldn't have known it, but for your insights. For them, it wasn't so much the business they wanted rid of. It was me.
So you've come full circle. You're back on your own with the business.
No. You've made me see the shop isn't a life sentence. Just a persistent habit. You weren't quite right in saying I took the same pride as my father in being a newsagent. It was what I've always been, but not in what you call my romantic way.
All right.
Not what I wanted to be. I've always had daydreams of being something of a globetrotter.
So?
I've sold the business to Alan Greaves. That's going through. He's agreed to keep on Mrs. Jackson to retirement age and leave the old folks in the flat. Merrill and the children have signed over the house and half the savings. Kevin gets the car. He'll collect it from the airport.
You're leaving now?
In a couple of hours.
For how long?
I don't know. See how it goes. I may not come back.
Oh. I wish I were coming with you.
You?
Yes, me.
You don't know where I'm going.
I don't care. Anywhere to escape.
Escape?
This pleasant, deadly dull life.
Well then, come.
I wouldn't cling.
You're not condemned to a life sentence either.
No. Last time you came here, you gave me a lift out with all my shopping. You must have wondered why I didn't take a taxi.
Didn't occur to me. It's a longish trip.
I did take a taxi once. Gerald said nothing, not in words. But I knew I hadn't to do it again. You know authority's trick of silent disapproval, don't you? If you think of your father. Or yourself.
All right.
Trivial. But then one finds oneself regulated by hundreds of trivial judgments, largely unspoken, and bound into a pattern of life made by somebody else. I know how Merrill and Kevin may have felt.
Yes.
Gerald's older than I. He was 32 when we married. I was 19. He's had a good career. He mixes with clever people. He's left me a long way behind.
I'm sure not.
He knows where he's going. If he gets into Parliament at the next election, he might still be young enough to become a minister. Everything lies ahead. And for me, as I said about your ladies over 40, the best part is over. My son won't be coming home. He's got a job in Germany. Gerald will stay all week in London. I'll stay here, or at some house we'll buy in his constituency, growing older. I'll look after the horses and I'll counsel people with problems.
You do it very well.
As though I've solved my own. As Colin says, who is to counsel the counsellors? What would you counsel me?
I suppose for you also the door is open. You've only to walk through.
Yes. I can't, Harold. Any more than you could a few months ago. What would happen to Gerald's prospects? And who'd look after the horses and the clients?
Oh, they'd get by.
I know. But I haven't reached the stage of throwing a music centre through the bedroom window. Until I do, I can't summon the emotional momentum to go. I look for the kind of pale compromise I urge on other people.
I'm sorry, Laura.
You need to be going.
I should, really. Thank you, Laura. I hope things work out for you as well.
I'll miss seeing you.
I'll miss seeing you.
Well, goodbye. You didn't tell me where you're off to.
Place I've never been before. Belém in Brazil.
Brazil?
For a start, I'm taking Kevin's advice. A trip up the Amazon.
Lovely.
Good luck, Laura.
Bring me a parrot back.
That was The Newsagent and the Counsellor by Don Howarth, and starred Stephen Moore as Harold and Maggie Steed as Laura. The play was directed by Kay Patrick.